From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson took his very first tour of Africa, visiting six different nations over several days. He cut short his trip by half a day, however, amid conflicting reports about his ill health and pressing matters in Washington. Tillerson, the former ExxonMobil CEO with zero political experience, had to conduct his African tour soon after President Donald Trump is reported to have made disparaging and racist remarks against African nations. More than a year into the Trump administration, there is still no clear approach to U.S. policy in Africa, and many are concerned about China's reach into the resource-rich continent. Now, a new book explores the history of Africa's development, analyzing Western imperialism and economic pillaging, which continues through today. Lee Wengraff is a writer and activist in New York City. Her articles have appeared in International Socialist Review, Socialist Worker, Review of the African Political Economy, and more. She now joins me to discuss her book, Extracting Profit, Imperialism, Neoliberalism, and the New Scramble for Africa. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Sonali. Thanks so much for having me.
So when we say the new scramble for Africa, of course, we're referring to a new era that is reminiscent of older eras where Africa's resources and people seen as resources were pillaged by outside countries. Let's start with history. I think very few people know about how the borders of African nations were carved up by the West. Going even before that is, of course, the slave trade, where 12 million people from the continent were essentially kidnapped. So how do you view that history as part of the arc of what we see today?
I think that's a great question. And one of the things that I really had as a priority in writing this book was to show that the history is far from being disconnected from the current state of exploitation and inequality that we're seeing on the continent, that a lot of the kind of parameters and the legacy of economic exploitation in the colonial era, both through corporate plunder, but also through state intervention, laid down policies and structures that continue to reverberate today. And whether that's through the overhang of old colonial relationships that still shape contracts that were signed right as these new states came into being, or whether it has to do with the weakness of particular institutions, educational levels, and so on, that colonial past shapes and very much informs the poverty and inequality that we see today. Of course, there's been several chapters in between these two eras, which I can certainly speak a lot about, such as the period of structural adjustment when Africa was really saddled with large amounts of just crippling loans because of a global economic crisis that hit Africa very hard. And I think now we're sort of emerging from that. There's a sort of narrative of Africa rising, but still that the inequality and exploitation that was shaped a century and a half ago continues to be felt today. One of the things that I tried to do in the book is to reintroduce this classic book by Walter Rodney called How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, reintroduce him to a new generation of readers. He is a Guyanese revolutionary who wrote an opus on this 500-year-old history from the pre-slavery period up through the modern day. And I really recommend that. And my intent was to kind of take the end of his book, which is around the late 60s, as a jumping off point to kind of extend those threads and understand relationships and inequality on the continent today.
So the Walter Rodney's analysis is so interesting. I'd never, honestly, never heard of his work, but the history that he writes about is very much, as you were saying, a part of the story today. Tell us a little bit about that history, the Berlin Conference of 1885 and their partitioning of Africa is a critical part of Africa's history, right?
Yes, absolutely. And really what emerged there, and that the Conference of Berlin was where the major powers, the major European powers of the time, really quite literally sat around a conference table and sort of made, divided up an imperial conquest of the continent and carving out essentially areas of interest between the French, the British, the Portuguese, the German empires.
Essentially their colonies, right?
Exactly. And so in an extremely short period of time, Africa went from a continent with nations that were had essentially were in the process of state formation and so on, to the vast majority of it, 90% of the continent emerging as colonized. And so that's really when people refer to the original scramble for Africa. That's really kind of the political act that set in motion, that in which there was a plunder for particular raw materials that were highly valued at that time, such as rubber and so on. Now, of course, the particular materials in question are quite different, but I would argue that there is a similarity today, and not just in terms of Western imperialism and designs on African resources, but really an imperial competitive battle between the other great powers, namely China today, and also Russia.
Right. So staying on that history for a bit, how did Western powers use the classic divide and conquer aspect of ruling a colony to foment, you know, internecine warfare? And how do we see echoes of that today, even involving corporations and governments?
Well, I think, there's a couple of things. I mean, part of what the colonial powers did was to look at the continent's resources, both in terms of human and material resources, as raw materials, as you said this at the beginning. And so imposing upon that infrastructure and state, local institutions and so on, that really best serve that interest. So, for example, cultivating local client tribal, so-called tribal leaders that were not necessarily reflective of the democratic aspirations of the colonized people, creating institutions such as schools and training that really were in the service of creating an African workforce that was fit to work in the mines, work in the rubber plantations, and so on. So it was a process both of carving out new national borders, new ethnic enclaves, and so on, but also creating a workforce that was essentially a pliant workforce and aimed solely at extraction. So you had, for example, over the course of the colonial era, where there African education actually reversed itself, and Africans were only educated to the extent to which they could do the jobs that the European colonialists needed them to do. And so, in the process by which these were these borders were sort of artificially imposed, there was a divide and rule dynamic in which there was a conflict and clash over resources, and in which these different ethnic groups were pitted against each other. And I think the Democratic Republic of Congo is probably an area that many listeners have heard some about. There's renewed conflicts there, very intensely resource-rich area, but in the Congo, also Rwanda, battles between between groups such as the Hutus and the Tutsis, which reemerged in the 1990s, have their roots, for example, in old colonial divisions over ethnicity, language, and so on.
And then you had the anti-colonial struggles and this generation of inspiring Pan-Africanist anti-colonial leaders that essentially drove out the colonizers. And that, of course, marked a really important turning point in Africa's history. And it wasn't a single turning point, it was a series of turning points. However, one of the myths that you take on in your book, you identify several myths, is that today Africans are passive victims of authoritarian African rulers. And there is this idea that African leaders kicked out the West only to reproduce those authoritarian structures here at home. And meanwhile, ordinary Africans remain at the whim of these rulers. How do you take on that very reductive view of what's happened in Africa today after the post-colonial struggle?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a great question, and there's a couple of different elements to that. I mean, first of all, as you say, that Africa has a tremendous history in terms of anti-colonial struggles that were actually the birth of the trade union movement in Africa, the student movement, peasant movements, and so on. Those movements certainly did not go away with the dawn of independent nations. I think that there was a generation of African state leaders in the 60s and 70s, in particular, people like Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana, Julius Nyerere in Tanzania, and so on, who represented, in particular, the kind of left aspirations of national liberation, who came to power on a program of national development, state socialism, and so-called in some cases, and there's a kind of generation of African socialists. These were not the only rulers. There's essentially different political wings and so on. There were African rulers that, after independence, hewed a little bit more closely to the former colonial powers. But I think that important piece of this of the puzzle here is that, particularly with the crash, as I mentioned before, of world economic prices, commodity prices in the early 70s, African nations that were very young and fairly weak institutionally, economically, were really thrown back on their heels and compelled to turn to the West for loans. And I think there began again a certain kind of...
Through the IMF and the World Bank? The loans through the IMF and the World
Yes.
Bank?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, which essentially went to these African nations with with hand outstretched, but really with very odious terms, in which African nations were forced to cut social programs and the kind of economic policies that would have enabled them to develop diverse economies and really develop a more economic independence. And so I think that in that context, you see the emergence in some cases of a more... this phenomenon of state capture, of autocracy, meaning that there has been a tendency in some African nations towards a shrinking of democracy, a shrinking of democratic space. But I think it's important to note, as you said, this is sort of a myth I try to confront in my book, that the idea that somehow that there is a lack of democratic movement or aspiration on the part of ordinary African people is very important to note. And up till the present day, there is a struggle and mass movements for mass-based democracy that we can see that right now in the Democratic Republic of Congo. There's a clamoring for Joseph Kabila to step down and so on. So I think that there's a very, as you say, reductionistic, very narrowing type of framework that corruption is only somehow the province of African rulers. It's worth also saying that the West is certainly chock full of corrupt companies and all sorts of corporate machinations, which I can has been seen on the African continent as well. I can certainly, I don't want to go too far off topic, but the Panama Papers and all of that, Paradise Papers, have revealed that corruption is by far not the province of African nations alone.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that point. So the title of your book is Extracting Profit. And of course, I think that there's a clear double meaning there because African countries have been very much subject to the kind of predatory practices of extractive industries, particularly oil. And there's this very, very sordid history of oil companies in various African countries like Nigeria, which you discuss in your book as well. How important is, what sort of era of the scramble for Africa does that represent? And does that industry still remain strong in Africa now that it's kind of become this haven for mineral extraction?
So you mean oil in particular?
Oil in particular. Is oil still as active? Are oil companies still as active in Africa as they were?
Well, something very interesting started to develop towards the end of my writing the book, which is that the U.S. essentially underwent something, you know, the shale revolution, which people are familiar with. Up until around 2010, the U.S. surpassed, Africa surpassed the Middle East as a source of oil for Africa. But over the course of the Obama administration, there was a strategic turn towards developing domestic oil sources in the United States. And the U.S. is now just recently surpassed Saudi Arabia as the world's second largest oil producer, just following Russia.
This is the fracking boom that you're talking about. Yeah.
That's right, exactly. And oil prices had dropped down about 2-3 years ago, had fallen by about 75% from the height, and now they've rebounded a bit, and really the African fracking industry is booming right now. So what that has actually been tough for African oil-producing nations, particularly in around 2016, 2017, GDPs in nations like Nigeria and Angola fell quite dramatically, and GDP as a percentage of per capita even more so went into the negative numbers. According to the IMF and the World Bank, those numbers are starting to rebound into the growth rate territory of 2-3%. At the height of the boom of the new scramble for Africa around 2009, 2010, many African nations were seeing growth rates of 6-8%. So, you know, that's a dramatic shift. Now, that's the picture of U.S. relations. Now, in terms of China and Russia and so on, but particularly China, oil still remains important. Oil still remains important to the U.S., but again, you know, bearing in mind the situation I just outlined. But China is really, in some ways, the dominant player.
Right. How has China done that? Because the West is very worried about that. And, you know, the neoliberals in government and around government are scared about the fact that the Trump administration doesn't seem to have a clear-cut policy because they're worried about China having really spent many years now extending loans to African nations and having corporate projects in industry in African nations, particularly around mineral extraction.
That's right. And this has actually been a process. This is one of the dynamics that I first drew my attention to this topic over 10 years ago, was that it was becoming clear that China's involvement in African nation building projects and in African economic development was really heightening. And part of that was the sort of the desirability of relations with China when compared to the overhang of structural adjustments. So you had the World Bank and the IMF, which had imposed extremely onerous terms on loans, and really an encroaching in many ways that I would call in imperial terms, and everything from state policy, economic policy, trade agreements, to requirements for good governance and so on. China really sought political relations with none of that baggage, it appeared. Now, I think that a decade or so later, and what that looked like concretely is a large wave of infrastructure building, where you have, for example, the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, was built by the Chinese. There's highways, pipelines, all sorts of bridges, hospitals, and so on, that had been built by the Chinese. And I think that that's one of a question I think that's important for the left to understand, and for progressives to understand, is that China, in my view, is an imperial country that is undergoing these projects for their own particular political and economic interests, that these are not humanitarian projects. And what I think is kind of unfolding now in more recent years is that, in fact, the Chinese do have terms of their own. They've been calling in loans. They have actually
so the loans kind of set up the leverage that they're now using.
Yes, that's right. I think that there's been a different political dynamic. China also historically has had, as a non-colonial power in terms of the prior colonial era, was able during the Cold War and afterwards to enter into African relations with sort of almost a clean slate, right, and play a particular role, as did the Soviet Union and Cuba to some extent in that period. But I think, again, there's been some areas that have been problematic. I think now that African states are starting to confront, for example, labor violations at various African work sites, mines. They have sidestepped and ignored particular local content requirements, which means that Chinese companies are sort of flouting any agreement to use local labor and importing Chinese labor. So what that means is that it reproduces those same relations of exploitation that we saw a century ago.
Lee, I want to just step back, though. We skipped over one important part of the story when, you and I are speaking here in the United States. The United States has used military force in Africa as a way to kind of bolster its interests. And under George W. Bush, there was a whole infrastructure set up under the U.S. African Command, AFRICOM for short. And it's interesting to see, of course, that there was some very strategic decisions made there. I'm not sure how President Obama wielded that military power and what Donald Trump is now thinking in terms of the U.S. military presence there. So if you can discuss AFRICOM as it relates to this idea of how the West has extracted profit from Africa.
Yeah, this is I'm glad you brought that up. It's an extremely significant development. So George Bush launched AFRICOM in 2007, and it's interesting as a side note that no African nation was willing at that time or since then to host AFRICOM on its soil. It's actually headquartered in Stuttgart, Germany. But in any case, there was in the sort of post 9/11 era and the beginnings of Islamic terrorism, so to speak, on the African soil, and generally coupled with the drive and the competitive drive for resources, that the U.S. administration began to look more strategically at relying on its military force, which is, really the kind of feather in the cap of the U.S. Arsenal, to mix metaphors, I guess, and there is a major military base was set up in the small island nation of Djibouti, Camp Lemonnier, and what's happened since then, and in fact, a lot of expansion happened in a very interesting and I think actually quite frightening way under Obama, which is that the military footprint of the U.S. military spread quite comprehensively across the continent. And what Obama did was he set up a large range of sort of more kind of hidden or small-scale forward operating bases, drone landing bases, and training operations. So there was a veneer of kind of partnership, cooperation on the part of the military under Obama, but really it was quite insidious, because what it meant was that there was American military fingerprints on African defense forces. So training, all this kind of thing, and really using this as a tool to shore up support for allies. So, for example, Uganda has been a recipient of a fair amount of military aid. But there's sections such as the Sahel region, which is sort of a band that stretches across Africa, which has been sort of seen as a key of the sort of northern section just below the Sahara, has been seen as kind of a key counterterror region. And it's where the U.S. has been strategically focused in terms of some of the fighting in Mali and now in Niger and so on. So this is something that I think is being played out in a very dangerous way. You mentioned at the beginning of the show that Rex Tillerson is currently on the continent, and I think he is leaving Tuesday the 13th. So he spent a whole week there, which is quite interesting, and I think is essentially promising an increased military presence. Somalia is a very important area where the U.S. military has been there as long as it has been in Afghanistan. China, on the other hand, has been steadily increasing its military presence there as well. About a year and a half ago, opened up a military base just footsteps away from the U.S.'s headquarters and the U.S.'s main base at Camp Lemonnier. There's other major powers that have military operations there. It's right on near the Suez Canal, so incredibly strategically important, just footsteps away from the Middle East. So I think in a fairly dangerous way, you're seeing unfolding imperial tensions that are spilling over from economic ones into military ones. I'm not necessarily suggesting there's going to be a full-fledged war on the continent of Africa between China and the U.S., but there are military skirmishes that are currently an outgrowth of some of these tensions. Mm-hmm.
I want to end, Lee, with a discussion of how, as someone who has studied this issue deeply, how you think things could have progressed or could proceed from now on in a way that doesn't leave Africa in shambles, that doesn't see rising inequality and continued poverty. One of the myths that you say is there in your book, people think of Africa as being cursed by natural resources. And that's, unfortunately, even on the left, a lot of people have had that approach or that lens through which to view Africa, the curse of the natural resources. This continent, rich in natural resources, has become pillaged and become the target for pillaging because of the natural resources. Why is that a myth?
It is a myth because I think the resource curse has been a little bit of a sort of easy way to sidestep the West and imperial responsibility for the exploitation of resources, and to paper over the fact that the extraction that's taking place on the continent has actually set development for ordinary Africans backwards. And so this is a resource curse that is not born of African kleptocracy or corruption or something that is somehow innate that Africans can never fight for and aspire and create democratically driven societies in which they make decisions about their own resources. In my book, I tried to show some examples of grassroots struggles in places like Nigeria and South Africa, where these questions, whether it's in the workers in mining workers union, for example, or communities in the Niger Delta, where activists and so on have organized together and said these are our national our natural resources, meaning they should be owned and the decisions made by all of us so that we can make fair decisions about the quality of the air, the conditions we work under, and an end to the sort of inequality. There's a lot of political changes that are really very interesting right now, the changing, rise to power, the taking of power of Ramaphosa in South Africa, I think is going to pose some challenges and interesting questions for the left there. And one of the most active forces on the left is the National Union of Mines of South Africa, NUMSA, that have often raised questions about the nationalization of resources. You know, we'll see. I also want to just say very quickly, too, that one of the things that Tillerson, and this is separate from the resource question, but I think important for those of us on the left in the U.S. to understand, is that the U.S. has been, as they've been funneling more money into defense, there has been a flood of both investments that are driving the theft of land and resources, some of that is our retirement of funds, for example, if you're a New York State worker, but also I think that social programs. Just 2 days ago, Tillerson in Kenya announced he was going to cut money, large amounts of funds from programs to treat people with AIDS, and this is devastating, and I think if ordinary people here in this country knew about that, I think there's a sense of solidarity and a sense of outrage that could drive some of that change that you right. alluded to.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Lee, for joining us today, and good luck with your book.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Lee Wengraff is a writer and activist based in New York City. Her articles have appeared in the International Socialist Review, Socialist Worker, Review of African Political Economy, and other publications. We've been discussing her newest book, Extracting Profit, Imperialism, Neoliberalism, and the New Scramble for Africa. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.